times, through Nixon and through Bush. Do you remember 36? We went our separate ways. You fought for Stalin, I fought for freedom. You believe in authority, I believe in myself. I'm a Molotov cocktail, you don't parry. Yo, baby, what's that confused look in your eyes? What I'm trying to say is that I burn down buildings while you sit on a shelf inside of them. You call the cops on the looters and pie throwers. They call it class war, I call it co-conspirators. 'Cause baby, I'm an anarchist, you're a spineless liberal. We marched together for the 8-hour days and held hands in the streets of Seattle. But when it came time to throw bricks through that Starbucks window, you left me all alone, all alone. You watched in awe at the red, white, and blue on the 4th of July. While those fireworks were exploding, I was burning, that swinging my black flag high, eating the peanuts that the parties have tossed you in the backseat of your father's new Ford. You believe in the ballot, you believe in reform, you have faith in the elephant and jackass. And to you, solidarity's a four-letter word, we're all hypocrites. But you're a patriot, you thought I was only joking when I screamed kill Whitey at the top of my lungs, at the cops in their cars and the men in their suits. No, I won't take your hand and marry the state. 'Cause baby, I'm an anarchist, you're a spineless liberal. We marched together for the 8-hour days and held hands in the streets of Seattle. But when it came time to throw bricks through that Starbucks window, you left me all alone, all alone.
Hello and welcome to the Circle Day Show on Resonance 104.4 FM. Today it's Janie doing a show, if you didn't guess from my voice. Today's show we're going to be talking about radical education and other issues surrounding education. I'm joined by Neil Fernandez, who homeschooled his son. If you want to say hello, Neil.
Hello.
I'm also joined by Alan, who is a TEFL teacher who spent time teaching in various places around the world.
Hello, radio.
And Jason, who joined me before Christmas for a show, who also homeschooled his son.
Hi, everyone.
So, if anyone's read the blurb on the website, I used the quote from Audre Lorde, which is, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. Sorry, someone's pulling faces at me. I guess that's the way that I see sort of state-run education. So we're going to go straight into talking about homeschooling with Neil, who has some quite strong feelings about it. So we're going to start off with, why did you choose to homeschool?
I think the main reason is that I'm extremely critical of the official education system, and have been ever since I can remember.
Ever since you were part of it yourself, maybe?
Yeah. Ever since I was like 5 or 6.
Your son went on to study maths at Cambridge when he was 15. How did you go about the journey from when, you know, he was, because you told me when we were talking before the show that he started reading when he was 2. So, you know, how did you approach the journey through homeschooling?
I actually started reading as well when I was 1.5, taught by my mother, who was a working class single parent. And so I've always known it was possible, and always had a contempt really for people who think that you know, you have to do things exactly at the age which you do in the school system. So I was never hampered by the idea that that it wasn't possible.
Jason, you told me a little bit just before the show about your experiences with home education. Do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about them? So how your child came to be homeschooled and the various positives and disadvantages?
I too didn't have a great experience of the school system, and so my partner and I at the time decided that we would homeschool straight from the, we call it home education. I don't like using the word home school because it feels like you're replicating something, which some people do, but that's certainly not what we intended to do or did. And he stayed home educated, but during this period we had him diagnosed as dyslexic, and we felt he needed more support, so we actually put him into a primary school. And for the first year it went really well, but by the second year it completely his relationship with his new teacher disintegrated, and they refused to give him a statement, so we took him out of school, and he was home educated then. We fought the local authority for 18 months to get a statement, and then that enabled us to access a specialist centre in one of the local secondary schools where he could have dyslexic support, and you could say he was flexi-schooled, homeschooled after that, until he went to college and then went on to university.
So I know you pulled a face when I asked you this question earlier, Neil, but I'm going to ask it anyway because I think it's really interesting, and I'd be interested for everyone who's present today to answer it. So other than home education, are there any other educational models which you think offer a better prospect for children? You talked a lot about child-centred education, so how would you define that? And
I think my basic answer to that would be no. One of the things about home education is that it's an extremely varied scene of different kinds of educational approach by parents, ranging from people who as Jason said, try to replicate or see themselves in some sense as replicating some of the form of instruction that goes on at school, to people who let their children run wild and don't really give them their children encouragement until they wait for the children to come to them, shall we say. Whereas I'm probably sort of off on a triangulated point somewhere from those two, or in the middle, however you want to look at it. So I would say in my take on education is that it's basically up to the parents. The parents are by far the most important influence and determining factor on how well a child is educated, whether they go to school or not.
I can't argue with that. What about you, Jason?
I think there are varieties of ways of approaching what a libertarian educational practice is. I mean, part of that practice is also not just about the idea that it's just the child-centred learning that we're focusing on, but also there's a broader aspect to the notion of engagement in society. So obviously there's been lots of different models tried out, from free schools in the 60s rather than the current incarnations, which have nothing to do with freedom.
I don't know much about that. Can you elaborate?
The free school movement in the 60s was heavily influenced by the ideas of A.S. Neill and Summerhill, but the idea was that it wouldn't be fee-paying, it would be done via through the state generally. Most of them got some form of funding. Some did last quite a long time as well. This is a history that's pretty much forgotten now, has to be said. And the idea in most free schools was that the children would decide to learn what sort of lessons they wanted or what educational experiences wanted, but it was also that they would also participate in the democratic running of the actual structure, that they would be participants with the teachers and the parents collectively. Most free schools were very small. There was only a couple that were beyond sort of the 20s. Most were actually under 20.
Alan, you've been nodding while we've been talking. Have you got anything to add? Or?
Yeah, no, I'd like to broadly agree with Jason that it's a question as well about the running of the school and the mechanisms around the school and how you regulate the school and who gets to decide in the school. I think there's perhaps two prongs to this. One is what happens in the classroom, and then if there isn't a classroom, or what the actual pedagogical elements, and then there is also the structure of the educational institution, if there is indeed an educational institution as a separate thing in of itself. I was trying to quickly think from my head of models perhaps which might be worth talking about, and one which I've been looking at and I'd like to investigate closer is the one being tried by the Zapatistas in Chiapas, Mexico. I think they are actually presenting an alternative model of education, which I don't think is perfect. I think it has its faults, and I think they're very aware that it has its faults, and I think they're very self-critical, and they're very willing to talk about it. But I think it does represent something where they are trying to involve the parents and the entire village, the entire region in the education of their children, and they are thinking very carefully and very definitely about what they want the children to do with their education, what the purpose of the education is, and they are trying to make this sort of transformative in a way. So I think that's the model that, I mean, sometimes people perhaps in the anarchist scene sometimes don't take the Zapatistas very seriously, but I think rather than say we agree with everything they do, I think taking them seriously means taking them critically. So that's something that I'd like to analyse more.
Could you outline a little bit what their educational model is? Like, my last show was actually on the Zapatistas, but we didn't talk at all about education. So,
I'm not, like I said, I've been to Chiapas. I've never set foot in a Zapatista school. Unfortunately, they had a great big event last year, where Escuelita Autónoma, where they talked in great detail about the sort of six prongs of Zapatista organization, and one of them is education. I wasn't there, unfortunately, I was somewhere else. But you can find the videos on YouTube if you speak Spanish. They're very interesting. There are lots of teachers and parents and students all talking about their educational experience. So from what I can gather is it's a sort of quite a mixed bag, really. Basically, because you have the five municipalities in the Zapatista territory, at first it sort of emerged quite organically, so each municipality developed its own sort of approach to education, and now they are trying to sort of bring their ideas together and make it more uniform. But it's become very decentralized, and it's very diverse. But I mean, they have managed to build 50 new schools. They have expelled all the state teachers. They've got 147 teachers themselves. They started off with only 20, and these 20 trained people who have very limited education themselves to become teachers. And they're very clear when they speak that they are teaching them tools to be useful subjects within their society and to transform the area around them. They do a lot of stuff about their own history. They do a lot of stuff about agriculture, but they also they teach them their own languages, which are generally not in the Mexican curriculum, any sort of indigenous languages. But they also teach them stuff that they need to survive in the broader world. I mean, people sometimes have this idea that Zapatistas live in a sort of bubble, isolated from the rest of the country, but no, they do get the bus down the mountain, out of the jungle, into the market, so they do need Spanish and they need maths. Yeah. One of the interesting things they said was that we don't just want to learn, we want to know about the philosophy, but we don't just want to learn that. Every time we go to the market, we never get the right change because people don't take us seriously because we're indigenous. They said, okay, we're going to teach you some maths, then we're going to give you a strong grounding in maths so no one can rip you off anymore. So I think it is a mixed bag. And I think one thing that's been said quite a lot is perhaps it's wrong to see them as perhaps a sort of an army, developing a sort of a new army of children who are going to conquer the whole of Latin America with Zapatismo. There's not this whole sort of idea from Paulo Freire that they're being educated to change the world around them. Perhaps they're already, what they're being educated in, the values that already exist there.
Yeah.
Perhaps the Zapatista territory is one of the few places in the world where you can say, well, actually, the mainstream culture is somewhere close to the culture we want to see.
Yeah. So maybe we can say, Neil, because we talked a little bit earlier about the challenge to home education when the last Labour government were in power. And maybe we can sort of seek into that gently about how home education allows you to kind of have more say over the culture that your children are picking up in school. Can you just explain to the listeners what the challenge was on home education and give us a little bit of background about the legality of being a home educator in the UK?
In the first part of the last century, it was actually compulsory for a while in this country to go to school. But when they introduced an Education Act, I think this was the one in 1944, I think, they had to make home education legal, or to say, or education otherwise than at school, by the parents, by the choice of the parents. They had to make it legal because the royal family weren't going to school. And so they didn't want a position where the royal family were seen to be breaking the law. So since then, the law is this, and this is now enshrined in the Education Act 1996. The parents can choose to educate their children at home, and in particular, I think one of the things that I've encountered people who don't know about, and it's quite important that people do know about this, is that parents who want to educate their children at home, whose children at the moment go to school, have the legal right to withdraw them from school immediately without any notice, without any period of notice whatsoever. All they have to do is write a letter to the proprietor of the school, which usually means the head teacher. And if you don't know who the proprietor is, I think their name is normally written on the board outside the school. All you have to do is just write a letter to them, say, I'm withdrawing my child from school and I'm going to educate them at home from now on. And the school is legally obliged to take that child off the register of the school. So in other words, as far as you're concerned as a parent, the school's then out. The school's out of your life.
Right. So maybe both Jason and Neil could talk a little bit about the challenges involved in being a home educator. So obviously it's a heavy burden to put on yourself to educate your kids if you don't have an educational background. So,
well, I certainly didn't. I haven't really got anything in the way of qualifications. At the time, my partner and I had a lot of free time. She was on what was the sick, whatever it particular incarnation of the time was.
Incapacity benefit.
It was before them days.
Oh, blimey. So, don't know what that is then.
And I was intermittently in work, part-time work, and so I had a lot of flexible time. I would say that poverty isn't the best, you know, form of resources, but the one resource you do have is time. And that our educational experience was that we wanted our son to have an experience which included broad socialisation with broad groups. And most home-educated kids' parents want that, and therefore you end up meeting in local groups.
Yeah.
And if we wanted to, we could have gone pretty much in the southeast of London every single day to a place where other children were meeting, usually in church halls, community centres, people's homes if they're big homes, nature reserves, adventure playgrounds. I mean, the joy of having an adventure playground for 30 kids who all get on, or if they're not getting on, come to you. Even the adventure playground workers loved it because,
yeah,
it, you know, it was the most relaxed because there wasn't a lot of peer pressure.
Yeah.
One of the great pleasures is that your children aren't peered. They aren't put into a small little age range where that's what they're supposed to interact with.
Yeah.
So you get a far broader engagement with older and younger children, and engaging in their well-being and their education as well. And I think that's a much more rounded and, in the end, much more natural situation.
Well, it's statistically, in pedagogical. No, can't say that word. That's what's known as vertical grouping, and it does have very positive results when it's collated into statistics. I mean, Neil, you said that you didn't actually concentrate on the socialisation so much stuff with your son.
We didn't go to home educational get-togethers that often, no. But I mean, he's still, just in the course of living your life, you get a child gets to meet neighbours and neighbours' children of different ages. And one thing I'd like to pick up on was that the different ages, other when you do go to home education get-togethers, the way that children of different ages relate to each other is much more friendly and congenial and pleasant than a lot of the stuff you get in schools. And when you look at school, the idea that you spend most of your time locked up with children of basically probably you know within 6 months or within a year of your own age is a very artificial environment. It hasn't existed very long in human history, and let's hope it doesn't exist for very much longer.
I mean, we haven't covered it yet, but our education system is based on the Prussian model. It's having no faces of recognition, but it was developed by the King of Prussia during the Napoleonic Wars, because he was like, oh, why do my soldiers keep defying orders and running away from gunfire? How can I stop them doing this? And that's why we have the very narrow age grouping and the bells and the uniforms and the large amount of children to one teacher. I come from a Montessori background, and it's as in I wasn't educated in Montessori, but I'm training in Montessori, and these are all issues that keep coming up but can't seem to be resolved. The conflict between money and society and education and what children actually want out of it seems to be quite broad. So I don't...
Yes, I mean, this society is I'm told I'm not allowed to swear, but this society is so messed up, shall we say,
yeah,
that that you're not going to get a perfect humanistic education where there isn't alienation that children have to deal with quite a lot.
Yeah. Alan, do you want to tell us a little bit about your time in Ecuador teaching English with indigenous people?
Sure, I would. I will definitely do that. First, I have a question for the home educators. How popular is this now, and how likely do you think it is that it's something that could be done en masse? I'm wondering, most parents might feel they haven't got the resources to home educate.
Well, in terms of its popularity, that's extremely hard to judge, because the numbers vary. The last study that was done on a basis of some samples, and on those samples it was essentially those who'd been in school and had come out and so been deregistered from the school. Local authorities produced various figures, and on the, they said they scaled them up, and it said, oh, it's about 7,500 to possibly 20,000 children. But
yeah, they don't know about everybody. So
well, they don't know about most people.
No, it's probably a few tens of thousands, I would say.
The highest figure I've come across, because I did do a bit of research trying to nail this down, was 80,000, but that was a lot higher than most. Most were saying probably around 40,000.
Yeah.
As to scaling it up, Yes, there would have to be certain changes in society for that, because an awful lot of parents are actually working, two parents are working, and obviously you can't do that. I think Illich had some very interesting ideas how we could do that on a much broader scale. I actually think, though, that it's an option. For me, it's one of the many ways that you can approach education for children, and not all parents are going to want to do it, but I think most parents want their kids to have a really good education. I think nowadays it's very difficult to have an informed debate about this, because there's so much media pressure and government policy pressure to reduce it all to results, standardisation. And the reason for that is because then you can go, oh, look, there's a league table, this is happening, you've got real choice. And, of course, real choice is actually something much more meaningful than choosing between a school that maybe, 35th or 67th in the league table, which would mean that essentially whatever those measurements really mean, well, they certainly mean there'll be almost no difference.
Yeah, to answer Alan's question with another point is that you do need time, and obviously you need to be able to survive, but you don't need academic qualifications to be a home educator, and you don't need a huge amount of money. It's
there are a large number of single parents who home educate. I mean, that in my experience is that was a remarkably large number of single parents home educating, which shows that, yes, they did have time, but they certainly didn't have money. And I think, you know, if you... HESFest, for instance, is Home Educators Summer Festival. It's extremely well organised. It's very well attended in the thousands. It's a summer camp full of activities, and some of them educational, in quotes, you know, some of them clearly not. And, you know, I can imagine broad-based engagement in a home-educated approach being very popular once it's much more widely known and understood and the fears removed.
So, Alan, you were about to talk about your experiences in Ecuador with the teaching English to the indigenous people and how that was used as kind of political point scoring for the central government.
Yes, quite. So, towards the end of last year, I took up a position teaching in the Amazon rainforest in a very, very remote, isolated community, which I had to fly to in a small jet. I was going to teach English there in a high school, a very small high school, which had minimal electricity. I had no electricity in the classroom. And I was teaching English, bizarrely enough, to students who were still getting to grips with Spanish. There was no communication with the outside world, really, in the village, apart from the radio was on for 1 or 2 hours a day. It was a very, very isolated place. And I was very excited to go because, I mean, part of it was I wanted to go and see somewhere totally different. I wanted to try and teach somewhere different. I was a bit sick of teaching really successful people from wealthy families. And I'd just read some alternative pedagogy, and I was interested in Freire and Ferreira Gadia and all these sorts of people. But I sort of arrived there and I thought it would be a perfect place to try out some of the ideas that I talked about by Freire, such as not using a child as a repository to be filled for the facts, but rather encouraging a child to look at problems on the child. The students to look at problems together with you and try and solve them together. I was very excited to try and use that, but actually, when I arrived, I found it was just like the most disciplinarian, militaristic environment I've ever worked in. You know, the students would stand to attention in line and order by class to sing a national anthem in three languages, but still to sing the Ecuadorian national anthem. It was very, very disciplinarian. There was a very narrow sort of corridor of acceptable behaviour, which was enforced by parents and by teachers. And the attitude of the parents and the teachers was that it sufficed for the kids to come to class and to be told facts, then go home having learnt those facts. It shocked me because all my TEFL teaching had been that, all my TEFL training had been that, you know, you have to get the student to understand things in their own terms, in their own way. You have to get them to use it, you have to get them to practice things. My students were were very, very resistant to even talking in class. They were used to having a textbook and being told to quote things, and being told to write things down as direct quotes. So it was a very difficult experience, really.
I'm drifting off because we're running out of time now. This has been a really, really interesting show, and I think it's definitely a topic that I'd like to return to. Neil, thank you very much for coming all the way from Cambridge to be on the show today. Jason and Alan, brilliant to hear from both of you as well. The Circle Day will be back next week. I think it's Donica's show, and thank you very much for a lovely production.
Separate ways, you fought for Stalin, I fought for freedom. You believe in authority, I believe in myself. I'm a Molotov cocktail, you don't parry your baby. What's that confused look in your eyes? What I'm trying to say is that I burn down buildings while you sit on a shelf inside of them. You call the cops on the looters and pie throwers, they call it class war, I call it co-conspirators. 'Cause baby, I'm an anarchist, you're a spineless liberal. We marched together for the 8-hour days and held hands in the streets of Seattle. But when it came time to throw bricks through that Starbucks window, you left me all alone.
white and blue on the 4th of July. You're listening to Loscombe's